This is a lecture series from Tikvah Ideas commemorating the Yom Kippur War on its 50th anniversary. Together, over the course of 6 lectures, we're going to explore what we know now about the war and what went on behind the scenes. Most Jews are disloyal, President Richard Nixon told his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, in 1971. He elaborated further, "Bob, generally speaking, you can't trust the bastards. They turn on you. Am I wrong or right?" These weren't the only anti-Semitic outbursts immortalized by the White House tape recorder. Naturally, Nixon explained to Haldeman, he made exceptions for his Jewish staffers, National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, White House Counsel Leonard Garment, and one of his speechwriters, William Safire. In fact, compared to the last Republican president, Eisenhower, the number of Jews around Nixon was huge. There was also Arthur Burns, the chief domestic advisor, Herbert Stein, the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, and Ed Davis, the chief science advisor. When the ethnic slurs on the tapes came to light, the Jews who had worked for Nixon were disgusted, of course, but also surprised. In Nixon's behavior toward them, they had never sensed the full extent of his bigotry. The focus of today's episode isn't going to be on Richard Nixon's prejudices, but rather on his Israel policies and on the policies of Henry Kissinger, one of his most trusted advisors. However, private conversations like the one I just quoted have shaped how Nixon's Middle East policy is remembered, in Israel especially, and in America among the pro-Israel community. What I want to do today is to examine how Nixon and Kissinger shaped the events that led up to the Yom Kippur War and the outcome of the war itself. I also want to share with you how delving into this subject has changed my own understanding of the history of the U.S.-Israeli relationship. Whatever his feelings about Jews, Nixon was quite popular among Israelis. As we've seen, he developed a direct personal relationship with Yitzhak Rabin, the future prime minister who was ambassador to Washington when Nixon first became president. Nixon respected Rabin and called him often to sound out his opinions. In 1972, Rabin openly expressed his preference for Nixon in the presidential election. In an interview on Israeli radio, Rabin said, "Never in America's history had any president gone so far in his pro-Israel declarations or in expressing America's commitment to Israel's security," unquote. Ma'ariv, Israel's largest daily newspaper, endorsed Rabin's claim in an editorial. It embellished on the theme by observing that no American candidate had ever aroused so much fear among Israelis as Senator George McGovern, Nixon's Democratic rival. Eager to pull American forces back from Europe, McGovern was prepared to hand the Mediterranean over to the Soviet Union, the paper claimed. With some 15,000 Soviet combat troops in Egypt, those policies would imperil the very existence of Israel. Ma'ariv encouraged its readers to tell friends and family in America to vote for Nixon. When news of Rabin's endorsement reached the United States, the Washington Post rebuked the ambassador in an editorial entitled "Israel's Undiplomatic Diplomat." But this only helped to get the word out. In the 1972 presidential election, Nixon's percentage of the Jewish vote doubled from 17% in 1968 to 35%. In the end, the bastards didn't turn on him. At the time, American Jews understood that Nixon had taken the U.S.-Israel relationship to a new level. However, they did not know all of the details. In the summer of 1970, Nixon had made a set of very significant commitments to Prime Minister Golda Meir, but he asked her to keep the particulars secret. By the time the archives opened, the Yom Kippur War overshadowed every other aspect of the Nixon administration's policy toward the Middle East. The commitments of 1970 were all but forgotten, but taken together, they constitute a revolution. From the perspective of half a century later, we can now see that these commitments changed U.S.-Israeli relations forever. They also shaped Nixon's behavior in the Yom Kippur War, and they were an integral part of the strategy that eventually reshaped the post-war Middle East. Before we talk about this revolution, however, let's spend a little bit of time recalling the nature of the old regime that it displaced. Since before the days of Truman, the State Department believed that America's association with Zionism damaged its relations with the Arab states. The Arabs were much larger in population than the Israelis, and their oil wealth made them indispensable to the security of the West. U.S. support for Israel, so the thinking went, was driving the Arabs into the arms of the Soviet Union. To hold on to the Arab allies and to stabilize the region, Washington had to prove that the United States was, in the parlance of the Foreign Service officers, an honest broker. This was a very loaded term. Previously, I spoke to you about how Israelis are divided between accommodationists and proponents of the Iron Wall. Those who believed in the honest broker approach were the U.S. analog of the accommodationists. In their view, the United States had to publicly distance itself from Israel to win credibility in the eyes of the Arabs. That meant that Washington must not be seen to encourage the territorial expansion of the Jewish state, that the supply of weapons must be kept to a minimum, and that the United States must present itself to the Arabs as an instrument by which the territory under Israel's control would be reduced. Only by proving that it was willing to curtail Zionism could the United States keep the Arabs on the side of the West in the Cold War. It was the honest broker approach that led President Eisenhower in 1957 to compel the IDF to withdraw from the Sinai. As I mentioned, this event made a profound impression on Golda Meir, who was foreign minister at the time. She remembered it in the 1970s like it was yesterday. These people, she writes in her memoir, these millions of people who even today have not quite grasped the realities of Israel's struggle to stay alive, and who are quick to condemn us for not being more flexible and for not retreating pleasantly to our former borders each time we are forced to go to war. These people might do well to ponder the course of events following 1956 and to ask themselves what was gained by the fact that we did reluctantly withdraw from the Sinai and the Gaza Strip. Those millions of people to whom she refers included Nixon's Secretary of State, William Rogers. In December 1969, Rogers launched a plan to end the war of attrition and settle the Arab-Israeli conflict. In his speech announcing the plan, Rogers stoked Israeli fears with the following two sentences. "We believe," he said, "that while recognized political boundaries must be established and agreed upon by the parties, any changing in the pre-existing lines should not reflect the weight of conquest and should be confined to insubstantial alterations required for mutual security. We do not support expansionism," unquote. These sentences provided a guarantee to the Arab states and the Soviet Union that America would return Israel to the pre-June 5, 1967 lines. If America was to make such declarations up front, Prime Minister Meir asked the Nixon team, how could Israel ever extract any concessions from the Arabs? Shouldn't the details of the withdrawals from occupied territories be determined by direct bilateral negotiations between the warring parties themselves? The general situation in the world did little to calm Israeli fears. The Vietnam War was going badly for the Americans, and domestically, the United States was politically polarized. Americans in general were looking inwards. Meanwhile, the Soviets were growing bolder, as evidenced by their military escalation in Egypt. With Nixon intent on detente, it hardly seemed fanciful that the U.S. might seek good relations with Moscow at Israel's expense. To make matters worse, there was the question of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 242. The Soviets and the Americans negotiated this resolution after the Six-Day War as a roadmap for resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict. The operative paragraph, Resolution 242, calls for withdrawal of Israeli armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict, unquote. It does not say from the territories, which would imply all of the territories. It just says from territories. The definite article did not fall away by accident. Arthur Goldberg removed it. He was President Lyndon Johnson's ambassador to the United Nations, and he explicitly stated that the text did not compel Israel to relinquish all of the territories that it conquered in the Six-Day War. Negotiations among the parties would determine the extent of Israel's withdrawal. The Arab states, backed by the Russians, rejected this reading. They insisted on interpreting Resolution 242 as if the was still there. In their view, it meant four things. First, that Israel must immediately withdraw from all of the territories occupied in the war. Second, that the details of the withdrawal would be worked out among the Israelis, the superpowers, and the United Nations. No Arab state would have to negotiate directly with the Jewish state. Third, that the termination of the state of belligerency did not imply a formal peace agreement, but, in essence, an extended ceasefire. And fourth, that all refugees would be repatriated to Israel. In short, it meant that Israel would make major territorial concessions in exchange for vague international guarantees, basically a repeat of 1957. To the Israelis, the Rogers Plan raised the possibility that American policy was moving toward the Arab definition of Resolution 242. They were not wrong to be concerned. The State Department mandarins resented Arthur Goldberg's text. Resolution 242 violated the prohibition of the honest broker school of American foreign policy, which was against American support for Israeli expansionism. Goldberg, a political appointee, hailed from outside the State Department. Even worse, he refused to listen to it. In addition to being a Zionist, he was also an experienced labor lawyer. If there was one thing that Goldberg knew, it was how to transform a text with the most economical of edits. The mandarins regarded his editing of Resolution 242 as an intrusion by the Zionist lobby into policymaking, just as in 1947 and 1948, they had resented President Truman's support for Israel and seeing it as an illegitimate assumption of their exclusive role. The Rogers Plan was a way for the State Department to reinsert the before the word territories in Resolution 242. Not literally, of course, but through policy. When domestic lobbies intervene in national security, the State Department believed, bad things happen. A definite article goes missing one day, war breaks out the next. Of course, the Israelis fought tooth and nail against the Rogers Plan. In this struggle, they received support from two surprising sources. The first was Henry Kissinger. When Kissinger first took office, many Jews wondered whether he, as a Jew and an immigrant, would steer clear of Jewish causes. To this day, in some quarters, the accusation that he is, to quote one historian, the archetypal assimilationist Jew, still dogs him. Kissinger believed that innocent human lives are best saved by the balance of power between states. He dedicated himself to creating a stable order in the Middle East, one that he believed would preserve Israel. He had very clear ideas about how to achieve that goal, which included building up Israeli power. And he fought hard and successfully to have his ideas adopted as official U.S. policy. This effort set Kissinger at odds with William Rogers and the State Department project of returning the definite article to Resolution 242. In Kissinger's view, the State Department had a mania for negotiating without any sense of strategy. He surveyed the Middle East and he concluded that the fundamental conditions for an agreement between Egypt and Israel simply did not exist. His goal was to create those conditions. In memo after memo to Nixon, he argued that the State Department's effort to buy goodwill at Israel's expense was rewarding the Soviet Union and Egypt for engaging in a major military escalation. The job of the United States, he argued, was to demonstrate to Egypt that it could not achieve its territorial aspirations by organizing the Arab states against the West and Israel, or by working with Moscow. The road to delivering Israel ran through Washington. The second source of support for the Israeli effort to scuttle the Rogers Plan came from the president himself. In 1971, when speaking to Haldeman about the fight between Rogers and Kissinger, Nixon called Kissinger, quote, the man that has the greatest influence on me, unquote. As for Rogers, he, quote, sometimes has a good idea, but not very often. That phrase, not very often, is the key. Regarding Middle Eastern strategy, Nixon was solidly on Kissinger's side. He did not trust the State Department. He deployed Rogers, an old friend, to manage the department. Meanwhile, Nixon brought all the major foreign policy portfolios into the White House under Kissinger. All portfolios except for one, the Middle East. He gave Rogers prime responsibility for the region for three reasons. One, it was of secondary importance, or so he thought. Two, the Secretary of State needed to be in charge of something. And three, because Nixon felt, as he writes in his memoirs, that Kissinger's Jewish background would put him at a disadvantage during the delicate initial negotiations for the reopening of diplomatic relations with the Arab states, unquote. Nixon also writes in his memoirs that, quote, I knew the Rogers plan could never be implemented, but I believed that it was important to let the Arab world know that the United States did not automatically dismiss its case, unquote. For Nixon, the Rogers plan was window dressing, a tool for managing relations with the State Department and the Pentagon bureaucrats, along with Arab allies such as Saudi Arabia and Jordan. It was also a way of signaling to Cairo that American and Israeli interests were not identical without committing the United States to anything. Like Golda Meir, Nixon concluded that Eisenhower's empowerment of Nasser in 1957 had been a blunder. In a memo to Rogers in May 1971, Nixon wrote that in 1956, this is a quote, in 1956, just before the election, we took a position against the Israelis, British, and French. This was a glaring error, and sometime in the future, I will have to admit publicly that the little part that I played in supporting it in the election campaign was a mistake, unquote. On the substance of Middle East strategy, Nixon marched in lockstep with Kissinger. The American goal was to demonstrate to the Egyptians that reliance on Soviet arms would get them nothing. To make sure that, practically speaking, the Rogers plan went nowhere, Nixon encouraged Kissinger to open a direct channel to Golda Meir through Rabin. As I've already mentioned, Rabin and Nixon thought highly of one another. Here's Rabin writing in his memoirs. The resemblance between Nixon's ideas on rapprochement with the Soviet Union and Israel's outlook on the future of the Middle East was almost uncanny. Rabin understood not just Nixon the man, but also his unorthodox methods, such as letting Rogers say one thing in public while the president told the Israelis something entirely different in private. The two developed an extremely productive relationship, one of the best, if not the very best, ever between Washington and Jerusalem. After the failure of the first Rogers plan, the Secretary of State launched a second plan. Branded Stop Shooting and Start Talking, it simply called for a 90-day ceasefire during which the UN mediator, the Swedish diplomat Gunnar Jarring, would explore the possibility of reaching a settlement between Egypt and Israel. It was in this context that Nixon made a set of pledges to Golda Meir, which mark a major yet largely unrecognized turning point in the history of U.S.-Israeli relations. A revolution, I would call it. Nixon and Kissinger both thought that Rogers' second initiative was also too solicitous of Nasser and the Soviets. To stiffen the American position and to encourage the Israelis to accept the ceasefire, Nixon delivered a primetime television address on July 1, 1970, in which he publicly committed to maintaining the balance of power that would protect Israel from its enemies, including the Soviet Union. Nixon followed up this public statement with a letter to Prime Minister Meir, in which he wrote, quote, I want again to assure you of my support for Israel's existence and security, and my intention to continue to provide Israel with the necessary assistance to assure that the balance of power will not be altered to the detriment of Israel, unquote. It was this assurance on which Golda Meir would rely in her darkest hour. I'm talking about the opening days of the war when she called her ambassador in Washington, who at that time was Simcha Denitz. She called him at 3 a.m. and despite the early hour, she told him to wake up Kissinger and Nixon immediately and get the resupply going. In her memoirs, she explained this odd behavior, the seemingly odd behavior, as follows. I knew that President Nixon had promised to help us, and I knew from my past experience with him that he would not let us down. Let me at this point repeat something that I have said often before, usually to the extreme annoyance of my American friends. However history judges Richard Nixon, and it is probable that the verdict will be very harsh. It must also be put on the record forever that he did not break a single one of the promises he made to us." Unquote. 5 decades later, we can see that these promises included what is now a cornerstone of U.S.-Israeli relations, namely maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge, or QME as it is now known in Washington. Israel, being a small country, relies on mobilization of civilian reserves for its defenses. It therefore must compensate for the larger land area and greater population of its potential adversaries through superior weaponry. Maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge is today enshrined in U.S. law, but the first documented use of the term in relation to Israel dates only from 1981, when Secretary of State Al Haig answered a congressional query in writing. Haig's letter is very revealing. Quote, "A central aspect of U.S. policy since the October 1973 war has been to ensure that Israel maintains a qualitative military edge," unquote. Haig was correct to assign the concept to the Nixon administration, but the basic idea actually predates the war. Its fundamental characteristics are clearly present in the Nixon letter to Golda Meir. But that letter did far more than simply promise to maintain Israel's military superiority. It also moved the American interpretation of Resolution 242 away from the Soviet Arab interpretation and much closer to the Israelis, which you'll recall was also Arthur Goldberg's interpretation. Nixon's letter informed Meir of his awareness that Egypt would seek a total Israeli withdrawal from the territories occupied in the 1967 conflict, and that they would also seek to solve the Palestinian refugee problem based on traditional Arab claims that endangered the Jewish state. "I want to assure you," Nixon wrote, "that we will not press Israel to accept Egyptian demands. Our position on withdrawal is that the final borders must be agreed between the parties by means of negotiations. Moreover, we will not press Israel to accept a refugee solution which would alter the fundamental Jewish character of the state or jeopardize your security." And with that, boom, the war over the definite article was over. Nixon's assurances to Meir on borders and arms foiled the honest broker agenda of the State Department forever. The government in Jerusalem regarded these commitments as an astounding victory. Rabin writes in his memoirs that some Israelis considered Nixon's commitment to Golda Meir, quote, "a latter-day Balfour Declaration," unquote. He is, of course, referring to the 1917 declaration by Britain, pledging its intention to establish a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. The Balfour Declaration marks the moment when the Zionist movement received the support of the world's greatest power. Once again, the greatest power on earth, which is now the United States, had created a strategic partnership with the Jewish state. In 1970, when Nixon first elevated relations between the United States and Israel, he asked Golda Meir to keep the terms of the new partnership secret. When writing her memoirs some 8 years later, Meir skipped over its details, but she described both its contours and her gratitude. Quote, "It should not come as a surprise that Nixon's resignation caused me deep regret. I was familiar with his virtues and his faults, both of which he possessed in abundance. Nixon helped to provide Israel with more arms than any other American president. For this and his strict avoidance of imposing an unwanted political solution on Israel, he is deserving of this country's profound gratitude," unquote. The commitments that Nixon made to Israel in 1970 were the key to producing a lasting settlement. I'm talking here about the Camp David Accords, a lasting settlement between Egypt and Israel, one that has stood by for 50 years, because they began to force Sadat to make a series of very hard and very clear choices between war and peace, between Egyptian nationalism and pan-Arabism, and between working with the United States and working with the Soviet Union. Kissinger's goal was to force Egypt to make these decisions by convincing it that it could not get what it wanted from Israel unless it worked through the United States. Building up Israeli power was crucial to that strategy. That meant pressuring them hard, pressuring the Egyptians hard, while keeping a line open to them. Kissinger understood that the Egyptians would be apt to make these choices only after a long and arduous process. As Kissinger was helping Nixon prepare the new commitments to the Israelis, he also began urging Cairo to put some distance between itself and Moscow. In the following passage from his memoirs, he describes a press briefing on July 26, 1970, which he delivered from San Clemente, where the president was on vacation. The Soviet Union's original intentions in sending combat personnel into the Middle East were irrelevant, I said. Even if they had been sent to shore up Nasser, their continued presence represented a strategic threat that had to be dealt with. We are trying to get a settlement in such a way that the moderate Arab regimes are strengthened and not the radical regimes. We are trying to expel, and that's the key word here, we are trying to expel the Soviet military presence, not so much the advisors, but the combat pilots and the combat personnel, before they become so firmly established, unquote. Nixon did not approve of Kissinger's blunt style in this briefing because it suggested a sharp U.S.-Soviet conflict, a potential military conflict. But he agreed with the substance of what Kissinger had to say. 4 days later, Kissinger offered a follow-up briefing in which he continued the same theme, but without using the word expel, which is what had caused the president consternation. I think, Kissinger said to the press, the Soviets realize that if they expand their military presence, the point will be reached where they must be challenged by the Israelis. The Israelis cannot permit themselves to sit there and be strangled gradually. Secondly, at some point of the Soviet presence in the Middle East, there will be some indigenous Arab forces that will have their own reasons for not wanting to substitute one colonialism for another. About 2 years later, Kissinger's suggestion that the Egyptians would chafe under the Soviet yoke began to come true. In Sadat's long and torturous road to peace with Israel, the summit between Nixon and Brezhnev in 1972 was a major turning point. The Egyptian leader had been publicly and privately pushing his Soviet patrons to pressure the United States to deliver concessions from Israel. Brezhnev, however, refused to take up Sadat's demands with the Americans. The joint American-Soviet statement from the summit spoke in terms of the normalization of the Middle Eastern situation, unquote. In his memoirs, Sadat writes that the statement gave him a violent shock because it legitimized the no war, no peace status quo that he found intolerable. Brezhnev further enraged Sadat by keeping him waiting for a full month before briefing him on the conversations in Moscow. In early August 1972, Sadat expelled the Soviet combat troops. He wrote to Brezhnev on August 30th saying that after the Moscow summit, quote, the American claim that the United States and the United States alone is capable of finding a solution has been increasingly vindicated, unquote. In Washington and Jerusalem, the public display of discord made it appear as if the Soviet-Egyptian relationship was in worse shape than it actually was. To be sure, relations were strained, and Kissinger's prediction was coming true. However, behind the scenes, Sadat also took pains to reassure Moscow that he was not, in fact, jumping over to the Americans. In October, he dispatched a top general to Moscow on a mission to seek more weapons. The junket was one of several steps designed, Sadat writes in his memoirs, quote, to show the Russians that in spite of the decision to expel the Soviet military experts, I did not wish to break with them altogether, unquote. Sadat was using the threat of a move toward the United States to convince the Russians to deliver more military aid. It worked. The Russians offered Egypt a massive weapons deal. 1 year later, when the Yom Kippur War came, Nixon and Kissinger acted in a manner completely consistent with the strategic concepts that they had expressed with admirable clarity, both publicly and privately. One can celebrate or criticize those beliefs, but one cannot deny that Nixon and Kissinger held them sincerely and applied them rigorously and consistently. In his memoirs, Nixon expresses the key idea that governed his thinking during the Yom Kippur War. Quote, despite the great skepticism of the Israeli hawks, I believed that only a battlefield stalemate would provide the foundations on which fruitful negotiations might begin. Any equilibrium, even if only an equilibrium of mutual exhaustion, would make it easier to reach an enforceable settlement." Unquote. Israel's lopsided victory in 1967, Nixon believed, had not worked to the complete advantage of the United States because it had humiliated the Arabs, made it politically impossible for them to compromise, and it also encouraged the Soviets to put more chips on the table. Nixon and Kissinger wanted a war that ended in a draw, but with the Israelis holding a clear advantage. In the end, they got their wish. War broke out, as we have seen, with Nixon drowning in the Watergate scandal and basically absent from Washington. Kissinger played the dominant role in the crisis. He kept in close contact with the president. In the opening moments of the crisis, Kissinger's instinct was to keep a line open to all the major players, Soviet, Egyptian, and Israeli. On Saturday morning, October 6, when Kissinger first learned of the impending Egyptian attack, and when he received Golda Meir's message that she would not launch a preemptive strike, he pocketed that commitment and reinforced it with his own warning to the Israelis not to preempt. He conveyed both the Israeli commitment and the American warning to both the Soviets and the Egyptians. Cairo and Moscow, as I mentioned in an earlier episode, undoubtedly received this message with delight. Sadat had tricked Kissinger. He had harnessed Kissinger's diplomatic ambitions to the Egyptian war chariot. It was rare for Kissinger to stumble in this manner. His decision to convey to the Egyptians and the Soviets the Israeli commitment not to preempt and the American prohibition against preemption invites the very same critique that he had so often applied to the initiatives of William Rogers, namely that his diplomacy was rewarding Soviet and Egyptian belligerence. How do we explain this mistake? Kissinger sought to contain the conflict. The mere effort would at least put him in direct contact with all the key actors, Israeli, Soviet, and Egyptian. Like everyone else, Kissinger was laboring under two illusions. First, that Israel was far stronger than Egypt, and second, that the war would end in 3 to 6 days with a massive Israeli victory. He and Nixon wanted to avoid a repeat of 1967, an oversized victory that would leave the United States with no diplomatic role. The Americans were also concerned about alienating the Arab allies. Finally, Nixon and Kissinger feared that Israeli preemption would provoke a Soviet intervention, which would turn the conflict into a direct competition between the superpowers. Nixon and Kissinger's goal throughout the conflict remained unchanged: to convince Egypt that it could only get what it wanted by distancing itself from the Soviet Union and moving toward Washington. What I'm trying to say here is that although Kissinger blundered in telling the Israelis not to preempt, he did so not out of a defective strategy, but out of a defective reading of the balance of power between Egypt and Israel at that particular moment. Like everybody else, he didn't see the power of the Egyptian blow coming. He was operating under the assumption that the rules that had governed the Israeli-Egyptian military interaction up to then were still operating. For the first 3 days of the war between October 6 and October 9, American policy remained based on this erroneous assumption that Israel would win quickly and easily. During that period, Kissinger opposed calls for a ceasefire in place. Such an outcome would allow the Egyptians to retain their foothold on the eastern bank of the Suez Canal. Instead, Kissinger called for a return to the pre-October 6 lines, believing that as Israel grew stronger and pushed back the Egyptians, Cairo would eventually come running to Washington. Again, that was a miscalculation based on the same strategy of trying to push Egypt or force Egypt to come to Washington and negotiate with Washington to deliver Israel. On Sunday morning, October 14, this was the logic that compelled Nixon to put his weight behind a massive resupply effort. Nixon called Kissinger to emphasize the importance of going big. Quote, "We are going to get blamed just as much for 3 planes as for 300. Henry, I have no patience with the view that we send in a couple of planes. My point is, if we are going to make a move, it's going to cost us. I don't think it's going to cost us a damn bit more to send in more. 2 hours later, Nixon called back for an update. If I contribute anything to this discussion, he said, it is the business that don't fool around with three planes. Just go gung-ho, unquote. When Nixon said we're going to get blamed if we go with three planes or with 300, he's talking about being blamed by Arab allies such as Saudi Arabia. And indeed, they did get blamed because Saudi Arabia started the oil embargo as a result of that. Nevertheless, they went gung-ho. The biggest weapons supply operation since the Berlin blockade of 1948. A total of 550 U.S. transport planes flew to Israel over the next few weeks. At its peak, one plane landed every 15 minutes. By the end of the first few days, the U.S. effort had surpassed the Soviet airlift to all of the Arab states. At the same time, the administration placed before Congress a $2.2 billion request for emergency aid in loans and grants for Israel. Nixon and Kissinger delivered on all the previous commitments to Israel, risking a confrontation with the Soviets, and they did so alone. The NATO countries were too vulnerable economically, that is, vulnerable to the Arab oil embargo, to assist. When the administration placed nuclear forces around the world on an alert in order to caution the Soviets about their possible intervention, critics accused Nixon of manufacturing the crisis to distract from Watergate. If anything, the opposite was true. Fear that the United States might look impotent due to the president's political travails convinced Kissinger and everyone else around Nixon that sending a big signal of seriousness to Moscow was absolutely necessary. In sum, Kissinger and a wounded Nixon were behaving according to their strategy, which called for demonstrating that the United States would not be cowed by Soviet moves and that regional powers, especially Egypt, could not attain their aspirations as long as they were working with the Soviet Union. They could only get what they wanted by working with the United States. Even today, this strategy remains controversial. Academic historians, writing from the honest broker perspective, castigate Nixon and Kissinger for refusing to pursue what they call an even-handed Middle Eastern policy. Conversely, many Israelis deeply resent the American policy of seeking a battlefield equilibrium. The restraints that Nixon and Kissinger placed on a preemptive strike, the delayed resupply effort, and the pressures for territorial concessions after the war leave a bitter taste in the mouths of many, even now. Among those who lived through the war, the denigration of Kissinger by the famous rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook has not been forgotten. Cook impugned the Secretary of State's loyalty to his people by calling him, in reference to his Gentile wife, the husband of the Goy woman. For those who remember Rabbi Cook's words approvingly, it's probably a good moment to pause and ask two questions. First, what if Kissinger had not been in office during the War of Attrition and the Yom Kippur War? Suppose that William Rogers had worked unopposed on the Middle East, or suppose that Lyndon Johnson's Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, or Jimmy Carter's National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, had taken Kissinger's place instead. What if James Schlesinger, Nixon's Secretary of Defense, had instead been Secretary of State on October 6, 1973? In the first high-level meeting of Nixon's advisors after the Yom Kippur War began, Defense Secretary James Schlesinger doubted that the Egyptians and the Assyrians had attacked first. It would be the first time in 20 years that Israel had not started a Mideast war, Schlesinger said. I just don't see any motive for the Egyptian and Syrian side, any motive to start the war. The second question that Israeli critics of Kissinger should ask is, which Secretary of State developed a more supportive relationship with Israel during a major Israeli war? The question answers itself. If Kissinger failed to give Israel everything it needed, precisely when it needed it, it only testifies to the fact that he was an American official. In the end, the interests of the United States and the interests of Israel are not identical, and they never will be, no matter who is in power. Given that obvious and insurmountable limitation, Kissinger did better by Israel than any other Secretary of State, in my view, at least. And let's not forget that Nixon empowered him. The same Richard Milhouse Nixon who believed that the Israeli victory in 1967 had not worked to the advantage of the United States, believed that Eisenhower's rollback of Israel out of the Sinai in 1957 had also damaged the American interest. The same man who refused to let Henry Kissinger work on the Middle East because he was Jewish ended up letting Kissinger manage almost single-handedly the thorniest Middle Eastern crisis since the foundation of Israel. The same Nixon who railed against the treachery of the Jews in private established Israel's qualitative military edge as a fundamental basis of U.S. Middle East policy. That same man permanently kept the definite article out of Resolution 242 and conducted one of the largest airlifts in history to save the Jewish state. Now, if you permit me, I will end this lecture with a quiz. Who was the first sitting American president to visit Israel? In recent months, I have posed this question to countless Israelis and American Zionists. Very few have answered correctly. One Israeli got it right, but only because he stood on the side of the road in Jerusalem, waving little Israeli and American flags as Nixon's motorcade rolled by on June 16, 1974, just 6 weeks before Nixon resigned from office. Nixon will always be the first president to have visited Israel. Nobody can ever take that honor away from him. But if the results of my quiz are anything to go by, Nixon won't be remembered for that achievement. In his infinite wisdom, the master of the universe hath decreed. The ugly slurs that Nixon uttered in private will forever overshadow the beautiful things that he did in public. It was the first direct peaceful engagement between Egypt and Israel after nearly a quarter of a century of hostilities. Since Kissinger negotiated this agreement nearly 50 years ago, not a single shot has been exchanged in anger between Egypt and Israel.